Grace to you and peace from God who creates and redeems and sustains all things. Amen. Sorry, I had the annual meeting up. If you'd like me to read the minutes of the annual meeting, I'd be happy to do that. So I read about a young man not long ago. And this young man, although his family was not terribly religious by any means, over time came to know God. He grew up in a community of relative poverty, where infant mortality and a certain amount of hunger were not at all unusual. He also grew up in a religion that became more and more important to him as a way of making sense of what was happening around him. He heard about God in his church. And in his church, most of the preaching was from the Old Testament. And it was rife with descriptions of a supreme God of judgment, of fear, and of anger. To him, as he learned in his church, sin was not only ever present, but it was almost like a predator that just when he least expected it would sneak up behind him and jump into him and make him do all kinds of awful things. Sin was really real for him. Even the stained glass windows and the art in his church depicted visions of a fiery hell that awaited anyone who slipped up in their morality or failed to produce good fruit for God. As he grew up in that church, those images of this vengeful, judgmental, harsh God came not only to be in the windows and the art and the preaching of his church, but also even within himself. Every day in this reading that I read, this young man, it saw in himself, if not real sin, at least the potential for it. So he felt horrible when he actually did something, but he felt even worse because there was always the possibility that he might do something. He saw God like a great figure holding scales. And on the one side was goodness and morality and right behavior, and on the other side was sin and degradation, and for him it always weighed heavily on this side. It's amazing how many people have grown up with that same image of God. I often wonder how that young man in that story would read today's gospel. You all weren't listening as carefully as the 8 o'clock service, because at the end of the reading in the 8 o'clock service, when the reader pronounced the gospel of the Lord, there was this sort of all-pervasive titter, because you will be thrown out into, you know, weeping and gnashing of teeth and burned in the fiery hell. The gospel of the Lord. This is the good news for today. Thank you for coming. This young man in the story, do you think he would have seen himself as the first slave who the master had given 5 talents to? Or would he have seen himself as the second slave who received 2 talents? Or would he have seen himself as the third slave. Now, it's important to remember where this story falls within the Gospel of Matthew. It's the second of the three images that will be brought out just before Jesus goes to die on the cross. The Matthean community has been waiting for Jesus to come back. And so last week they warned everybody, you need to be watchful. Don't be the virgin bridesmaid who forgot to bring their oil. And then this week, it's almost as if it was like a merchant who went away for a long time. The Matthean community has been waiting 80 years for Jesus to come back. And the merchant left with his slaves a certain amount of money. Matthew likes to go big. I mean really big. In the original story, the merchant had left minas, 10 minas with the slave, which is a fairly small amount of money. But in Matthew, it's 10 talents. How much is a talent? So a talent is 37 pounds of something. In today's market, it's $1.28 million. 5 talents, about $10 million. You know, Matthew, go big or go home. The other part that we don't understand about the lesson, because we want to allegorize this lesson, right? We want to make God be the merchant who goes away for a long time, and then God's servants, the church, would be the ones who receive the talents, right? So, well, we haven't gotten a $10 million bequest yet, but it could be coming. And in that schema, the master goes away and leaves you with a responsibility. $10 million worth of responsibility. And the first one not only goes out and helps make it grow, but doubles it. So suddenly you've got a lot of money. And the second servant, God bless him, also does the same, doubles the money. But the man in the story that I told you at first probably would have seen himself as the third person. When the master comes back, he says to the master, I knew you were a harsh person, gathering where you did not sow, reaping what you did not plant, taking what didn't belong to you. You are a harsh person, and so I did what any rational person would do. I just kept it. I put it in the ground. As one commentator said, he literally made a deposit. He put it in the ground out of fear. David Loess, in his commentary about this text, says, well, is it any wonder? Isn't it interesting that the first and second slaves don't seem to be worried about the master? They don't worry about it. And they've got a lot more to lose, right? And secondly, how much of this money do the slaves get? None. Not a dime. It's not their money. So when we allegorize this and we make it be God is the person who is the merchant and the church and the faithful servants have done these good things and these almost really great things, and then there's the rest of the slackers, the Lutherans, who, in fact, like bury it in the ground on a regular basis and hope for the best. As David said, maybe this has not a lot to do with that because it doesn't make sense, right? How does the story end? The guy who is conservative and who just tries to do the right thing is the one, he's the poor one, and what happens to him? He goes to hell. Well, what happened to the fifth chapter of Matthew? Blessed are the poor. And then in this text where it says, those who have a lot will be given more, and those who have nothing will have even that taken away from them. Well, what's happened to this imagery in Matthew throughout the rest of Matthew, where God clearly has a preference for the poor, and where the rich are the ones who are held accountable. So the allegory begins to unravel. It's not the easy, direct sort of idea that we want it to be, because we love the story in the end because it's so much a part of our experience. If you do well, you're rewarded, and if you are lazy and you bury your money in the ground, what happens to you? You barely get Social Security. But what if this has to do with how we image God? David Lowes was saying in his text, and I kind of like what he had to say, is it any wonder that the third slave was scared to death when his image of the master was so intact? It's like the young man in the story that I told you. Of course God was judgmental and horrible, and he lived in fear because he had been raised from the very beginning to believe that's who God is. Sometimes the God we receive is the God we imagine. And so for the early church, they're on the crux of what they believe to be the coming of God in judgment. And with harsh words and images, they goad God's people into submission. Is that your image of God? Is your image of God, if the image of God that we want to promulgate in the world is one who judges and throws us into the fiery pit, if our image of God is like the image in the first lesson that we received this morning, so well read by Karen, with all the correct pronunciations of the names, God will not strike you down. Did you listen to this story? God's people are unfaithful, and so God brings in their enemies to destroy them and enslave them for 20 years. And then as a reward for having been used to enslave the people of Israel, what does God do? Destroys the enslavers. Is it any wonder that no one comes to church if that's what our image of God is like? Let's break out the paintings of hell and damnation. One day this young man read the Gospels. Not the text that we read today. But he began to read about a different God. This God looked different than the one who stood and held the scales on which he found himself teetering in every moment of his life. This God who he read about said to him, "I will love you forever. You are my child." Not only that, this God is the one who will come later, just a little while later in Matthew, right after this text of God being this terrible righteous judgment, what happens? He dies on a cross so that God's people can find life. Suddenly, the images that this young man had of God were not just of the old man sitting in a chair with a lightning bolt waiting to strike him down, but of Jesus breaking bread with his disciples, shedding his outer garments and washing the feet of those around him. He began to see God as an image of one touching and healing the leper and calling the children to come and gather at his feet. Like the young man in my opening story, maybe sometimes our image of God invites us to have the God we imagine. But maybe that's not the God who is calling us. So how do you envision God? What is your image of God in the world? Great friend? Terrible judge? Long lost power speck somewhere in the cosmos? Nothing at all? How do you image God? If we remain stuck on this God of judgment and terror and horror, it is no wonder no one comes to church. If our vision of God is such that we create a world where no one cares, is it any wonder that no one wants to come to God? Matthew in this text is drawing us through judgment toward the cross and resurrection that will follow right after. Matthew wants us to see that God is neither Buddy Jesus nor Zeus on a stick, but that God encompasses all of our life in God's joy. One day, the young man finally understood God's grace and began to at least have some peace with the God of his childhood, and found instead this God of grace who promised to be with him forever. And it became such a powerful image in his life that he spent the rest of his life telling us all about it. You probably by now have figured out who I'm talking to. Don probably did in the second sentence. It's old Marty, old Martin Luther. He started out with a God who wanted to destroy him and ended up with a God who had a heart of love. What a beautiful way to make a journey in faith. And may that same journey accompany us on our way in God's Spirit. Amen.